Case number 12-5310 et al. National Mining Association et al. Versus Gina McCarthy, sued in her official capacity, Administrator, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency et al. Appellant, Hazard Coal Corporation, and case number 11CV44CRBW et al. Mr. Littleton for Appellants EPA et al. Ms. Chuse for Appellants Sierra Club et al. Ms. Nathanson for Appalachian National Mining Association. Mr. Bailey for Appalachian West Virginia et al. And Ms. Stevens for Appalachian Commonwealth of Kentucky.
That's not the first time it's happened. And that happens up here sometimes.
Yes.
And don't worry, the clock is not running yet. That's what this is. The clock isn't running yet, Mr. Littleton, but will you remind me, we have divided this up. Various counsel are going to argue various issues. If you could just remind at least this judge who's going to be arguing what.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Matt Littleton. I represent the United States. With me this morning are Mike Lee from the EPA and Russ Pettit from the Army Corps of Engineers. I'll be arguing for 15 minutes this morning. Emma Chuse, at council table with me, is going to be arguing for the intervener appellants for 5 minutes. The intervener appellants have not raised different issues than the United States.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court. The district court committed reversible error when it set aside the enhanced coordination process, the screening procedure, and EPA's guidance memo. I'd like to touch on all those actions this morning, beginning with the enhanced coordination process and screening
procedure.
Can I
ask you sort of a big picture approach to this? And is it your argument that Congress has expressly given the EPA the authority to do what it has done here, or is your argument of a different nature, and that is that the EPA doesn't need express authority to do this sort of activity that might be sort of interstitial activity? Which is it?
So based on the Supreme Court and this Court's case law, our argument is that agencies are presumed to have broad procedural discretion, absent an express statement by Congress that the agencies are authorized or need to institute a particular procedure, so that the Corps and the EPA, like all administrative agencies, have broad discretion, absent what Vermont Yankee called extremely compelling circumstances,
How about an instance where the district court here at least seemed to think that no, Congress had looked carefully at the relationship between the EPA and the Corps, and to protect some very fundamental values, set forth limitations on what EPA could do, and set forth by sort of, it's almost an enumerated powers sort of argument that Congress had said, EPA, in this area, you can do this, and by implication, saying, we don't want you doing anything more than that. So are you conceding that there's no textual basis, there's no express authority for the EPA to do this, but rather there's this sort of implied general authority?
Our argument is that part and parcel with the substantive authority that Congress gave both the Corps and EPA under Section 404 to evaluate the same discharges, the Corps has authority to specify disposal sites in the course of issuing permits, and EPA has authority under Section 404C to prohibit or restrict.
Well, that's a specific example, and that's
right.
One the district court cited. But
so
there's more involved here than exercise of that veto and how it's done, right? Or are you claiming that 404C authority gives the EPA as a grant authority to do things more broadly than just consult with the Corps on the exercise of its veto and disposal sites?
Well, certainly EPA and the Corps are authorized to consult with one another, and in fact there is express language in Section 404 B, C, and Q related to that. Congress clearly envisioned that the agencies would coordinate. So
coordinate as to specific goals, specific activities, right? Or are you saying the 404C authority to coordinate, which, as I understand it, is targeted at the EPA's exercise of its veto authority over disposal sites, are you saying that that is basis for a general, let's consult about all sorts of things?
Well, it's a basis for, with again, this is a, although this was a generalized procedure applied to a defined set of applications, the inquiry was on a permit-specific basis right. in all cases. Right. And so with respect to any particular permit, the agencies didn't need to formalize a particular process to be able to coordinate. This sort of coordination happens all the time, not only in this context, but also in contexts where Congress has been less express about the need to coordinate. And so agencies, as a matter of practice and a general principle of administrative law, have the ability, when they have substantive authority, to institute whatever procedures they deem are necessary to carry out that authority. And that can include interagency consultation, as occurred here. And so we are not pointing to a place where Congress said the Corps and EPA can enter into the enhanced coordination process specifically. That almost never happens.
That's not necessary.
That's not necessary at all. And for that, again, I would point the Court to the extensive Supreme Court and precedent from this Court that we cite in our brief that the plaintiffs have not contested. This is a matter of fundamental principles that procedures are different than substantive authorities. And contrary to the plaintiff's contention, there's no place in the enhanced coordination process where EPA took over permitting responsibility. EPA was able to specify disposal sites.
Tell me about the process of the enhanced coordination process. What takes place? What is it?
So, again, this was a defined list of applications. In mid-2009, the agencies faced a challenge, which was there were a list of long-pending permit applications over which there were substantial environmental concerns. And so rather than take this on an individual permit-by-permit basis and perhaps have meetings, phone calls, one-on-one with the permit applicant or with the other agencies, the two agencies decided that the best way to proceed was to be upfront and say, when the process begins, there's a focused 60-day period of coordination. And that involves the permit applicant, it involves state permitting agencies, and it involves both agencies here. And at the conclusion of that process, the understanding was that the Corps would proceed expeditiously to determine whether to issue a permit, and if so, on what terms. And if the Corps determined
well,
that...
Well, you're describing it makes it sound like it's just two parties getting together and saying, let's hurry up and get this thing done.
That's exactly what it is.
That's all it was. So are there any instances in which the Corps went against a recommendation of the EPA? In any instance where the Corps said, we hear what you're recommending, but we're not going to do it. We're not going to give elevated scrutiny to this particular permit, even though you think it's a good idea. Any instances of that happening?
There's no instance in the record of that happening, although certainly the Corps could have done that, and at that point, EPA, if it wanted to, would have chosen to initiate 404C proceedings, exactly as the statute.
Any instances where the Corps rejected the conductivity standard that had been recommended by the EPA?
So this is seeping a little bit into the substantive argument, but one example is from the plaintiff's declarations at JA 430 of the record, where an applicant, Czar Coal Corporation, was put into the enhanced coordination process. Its application had been long pending for well over a year before the enhanced coordination process started. The agencies went through a targeted procedural review as the enhanced coordination process envisioned in early 2010. At the end of that, the Corps proffered a permit to Czar Coal, and that included a condition related to conductivity that the permit applicant disagreed with. So the permit applicant administratively appealed to the Corps. The result of that process, as indicated on page JA1111 of the record, was that a permit was issued with a much higher conductivity limit of, I believe it was 1560 microsiemens per centimeter.
Then why have the guidance at all if we're seeping into the substantive issue? What was the purpose of the guidance?
So now we're going to the guidance memo, and the purpose of the guidance is the purpose of any guidance. I mean, as this Court indicated in Pacific Gas, guidance can serve salutary purposes even though it's not a legal change. It's to...
Didn't it alter the legal calculus here? It basically creates a benchmark, a rebuttable presumption that over 500, a level over 500, is going to be problematic?
No, Your Honor. It didn't do that on its face, and the plaintiffs haven't argued that it did. The question is whether, in practical terms, it had that effect. Mm-hmm. And the plaintiffs, we've provided several examples in which permits were issued without...
Then why have the guidance? And when the administrator announced the guidance, the administrator made clear that this is a clear statement of where EPA stands and what we expect from any mining projects going forward. These are benchmarks for conductivity. The steps we're taking today will help outline the clearer path. And the purpose of the guidance, as I read it, and we have a lot of case law on this, as you're well aware, starting with Appalachian, was to outline how this was going to work going forward and to make clear that over 500 was going to be scrutinized more closely than it had been before.
Well, it certainly was going to be scrutinized more closely, and the permit applications in general were to be, in light of the agency's review of past permit applications in these states, there was a major concern, as well as the informed by the growing body of available science related to conductivity. So, yes, there was going to be a change in enforcement practices or patterns, but that's a general change, and there wasn't a specific legal obligation that
was
changed.
So how is it different from Appalachian?
It's different from Appalachian because in Appalachian, first of all, there was, the court noted in that case, that the language on the face of the guidance document was binding. It purported to be binding. The only thing was a paragraph disclaimer at the end of the document. Here, the plaintiffs haven't pointed to any place in the document where, with respect to the conductivity, for example, EPA said, no, this needs to be applied like a numeric water quality criterion.
Right.
It was very clear that the agencies could use different levels of conductivity depending on site-specific circumstances, or not even use conductivity at all.
So are you okay with an opinion, then, that says state permitting authorities are free to ignore the guidance and it can't be used against them in any future legal proceeding and has no legal impact whatsoever?
Absolutely. The guidance has no legal impact. Now, obviously, if state permitting...
Are you okay with all of the above that I said?
So it has no legal impact.
Yeah.
The state permitting authorities, yes, they are free to ignore it, but as a consequence of that, they may face more comment and objection letters from EPA. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, if EPA goes through the objection proceeding and takes over...
And their whole... I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, and once EPA objects and takes over that authority, right, then if there's a problem that the permit applicant has, it can contest it.
Their whole point, I think, is why not review this now rather than later? Kind of Abbott Labs' point. Why not review it now rather than later so that we know whether it's lawful for EPA to insist on this conductivity standard when they say the state water quality standards don't allow consideration of conductivity, at least not at that level. In certain states like West Virginia, it's not considered at all. And so you're effectively changing the standard. Let's review the legality of that now rather than 3 years from now.
Well,
what's wrong with that?
Based on the record of this case, Your Honor, that's not what happened. West Virginia came out with the permitting guidance and said that in this state, conductivity is an appropriate way to determine compliance with this narrative water quality standard. EPA didn't come in and say, no, no, no. EPA said, in the context of any particular permit application, we'll look at what you have to offer. And so it is true, Your Honor, that there were a number of comment letters.
But that contemplates that in certain cases, unless the guidance is just worthless, which is not how it was advertised, in certain cases, EPA is going to come in and say that the conductivity level is too high. In fact, the administrator specifically said this is going to make fewer, no permits that are going to be above 500 are going to be approved. And they're saying that's a different legal calculus than what West Virginia law sets forth.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that, again, the conductivity challenge is specifically, the plaintiffs were arguing that this was a numeric water quality criterion above and beyond the existing state narrative water quality criteria. Mm-hmm. And it's, if anything, it is closer to what...
Is it a rebuttable presumption? Did it establish a rebuttable presumption? And if it did, first of all, did it? And then do you have a position on whether, if it did, does that pose a problem for you?
So at most, it is a rebuttable presumption, Your Honor, and it would depend on site-specific circumstances. Even if that were the case, though, under Catawba County, that wouldn't suffice to make agency action final. This is exactly the sort of challenge that needs to be brought in a permit-specific context, because as we pointed out, there are numerous examples in the record where EPA allowed permits to issue that had all sorts of limitations, conductivity and otherwise, and even within conductivity at specific levels.
But their point is this makes something relevant in the calculus that going forward, that under the state water quality standards of certain states is not a relevant factor, and therefore it's unlawful for EPA to make this factor relevant, and we want to have judicial review of that now rather than 3 years from now. And the practical impacts of this, which is what the whole Appalachian line of cases was about, was not being deceived by agencies attempting to essentially evade Abbott Labs. And I'm not talking about your purpose here, but I'm just talking about what Appalachian was all about, was not postponing judicial review in these circumstances.
Again, there's a difference in the case law throughout between practical consequences and legal consequences. And whatever the guidance memo said, the guidance memo was never used as a source of legal authority. The agencies were proceeding in a similar fashion before the guidance memo was even issued, as we point out in our reply brief. And so there's been no change in law. What's changed is the background science. And yes, it's true, the guidance memo summarized the growing body of science related to conductivity. It said, this is what we consider this important. This is something that agencies should, the state permitting authority should be looking at. That's all the guidance said. And as a result of that, yes, there have been changes in enforcement patterns. There always are under new administrators. But there's been no legal consequence that would merit reviewing this guidance.
So when the administrator said you're talking about no or very few valley fills that are going to meet this standard, was that just incorrect?
Well, I think, you know, an offhand comment of the administrator about the guidance memo shouldn't be...
Well, there's a prepared statement, and then there's that comment that was made that's quoted in the briefs as well. Is that...
Well, I think the point is that the guidance memo...
So that was wrong.
If the guidance memo had imposed that legal conductivity standard, then yes, it would be final agency action. Our point is that it did not.
Mm-hmm. And if let's suppose that it does... Let's just hypothesize something, that EPA did put in something that said permits won't be issued if it's above 500 except in extraordinary cases or something like that. Can you defend that on the merits?
So if EPA had adopted a numeric water quality criterion without going through the statutory procedures, mm-hmm. then yes, that would be a statutory violation.
Okay, because you have to go through the 303 process. Or what's the process by which EPA can object to an existing state water quality standard?
It's under Section 303, I believe it's 303C4. Mm-hmm. If there's a water quality standard proffered that EPA disagrees with, it can go through and ultimately take federal authority to institute that water quality standard.
Can I follow up on one of Judge Srinivasan's points as well? Lots of rules establish rebuttable presumptions. They're still rules that are reviewable, right? That can't be the hallmark of something that's not reviewable.
I would point the court to Center for Auto Safety, Catawba County, and several other cases cited in our brief where the court has said the agency retains enforcement discretion if it hasn't actually taken the action necessary to have legal effect, then the memo or what have you is not final agency
but
action.
In a rule that everyone admits is a rule, the agency says this is a rule, but the rule establishes a rebuttable presumption.
Yes, in that case.
So the rebuttable presumption can't be the hallmark of what distinguishes a rule from guidance, can it?
Well, again, you look at the text of the guidance memo on its face, and it's conceded by the plaintiffs that it's non-binding on its face, and then you look at how it's been implemented in practice. And the reality is the plaintiffs can't come up with a single example in which there was a permit issued with this conductivity limitation. And they're pointing to specific instances in one state where EPA acted in a manner consistent with the underlying science and underlying concern expressed in the guidance memo, but that's not sufficient to make the memo as a whole a final agency.
You're talking about the practical effect part of the analysis when you're dealing with rebuttable presumption, I take it.
That's right.
On conductivity. Can I just ask one question about...
I have a few more, too. Go ahead.
Oh, no.
go ahead.
On the same line, then.
Go ahead.
Okay. Not on conductivity, but on the other, the RPA part. There's a statement in the Joint Appendix at 1064 that says in order to submit a complete NPDES permit application for an individual permit, the applicant must present data to properly characterize its discharge to enable reasonable potential analysis to be completed by the permit writer at the time of the permit issuance. And so it uses the term must, which is a little bit different from the term should that's used in other places. And the district court focused on that statement to some extent. Can you address that part of it?
So that statement relates to an aspect of the guidance memo that hasn't been challenged by the plaintiffs, which is what information needs to be presented by the permit applicant. There are regulations at 40 CFR. There's a typo in that. If the citation in that sentence is supposed to be 122.21G7. Uh-huh. 40 CFR 122.21 sets forth several requirements for permit applicants to provide to state permitting authorities. So that aspect of the guidance simply restated what the existing regulation said, and plaintiffs haven't challenged that's not what it says.
Okay, so your view is that there's nothing other than what the existing, even though the existing one, I thought, even if we correct it what is the correct provision?
It's
2.21.
Right, exactly.
2.44, which deals, I think, only with existing permits. Is that right?
I believe that deals with all permits.
Oh, does it?
I'll have to go back and double check that, but I believe it is all permits.
But your view at the end of the day is that doesn't change anything, that's just a restatement of what?
That's a restatement of existing law with respect to the application requirements, yes. And that, again, that's not an aspect of the guidance that's been challenged here.
Could you explain how the challenge would work in individual permitting decisions, just so we're clear on that?
Sure, and I guess I'd ask to specify which aspect of the guidance.
So the conductivity.
So, for example, if the state permitting authority, let's say it adopted the recommendation of EPA and imposed a 500 conductivity limitation, then the Clean Water Act and EPA's regulations provide that states must provide a mechanism for judicial review of those permit conditions, and so it would go to state court probably.
How about if the state goes the other way and rejects EPA's approach, doesn't impose a conductivity limit, EPA objects, what happens then?
So EPA objects, and then at that point, the permit applicant or the state has an opportunity to modify the permit in light of the objection. If the state chooses not to, then permitting authority passes to EPA. In that case, EPA would make a final decision about what permit conditions to impose. If the applicant disagreed with those permit conditions, then there is administrative appeal process and judicial review available under EPA's regulations. So the applicant would have a direct opportunity to contest those in an individual case.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's all in statute, right? To be clear, that process is laid on the statute. It's not.
The administrative appeal process is in EPA's regulations, but.
The part that says that if the state doesn't modify in a way that's. That conforms to what EPA suggested, then EPA takes over the permitting authority. That comes.
That's right. That's in Section 402D of the Clean Water Act.
Why was the guidance put out for public comment?
Your Honor, the EPA recognized that there were going to be lots of parties who were affected by concern about the issues raised in the guidance. It said, here's the available science that we're looking at. Let us know if you have more science. Let us know if we have sufficiently clarified the existing law and indicated how EPA regions are going to proceed. They got several comments on that and modified the guidance accordingly. We don't think EPA needed to go through a notice and comment process, mm-hmm. but the fact that it did doesn't invalidate the guidance.
You said parties, they wanted to put it out for comment by parties who would be affected by it. If it's just guidance, I thought your point was it has no effect on anyone.
Fair enough, Your Honor. Parties that would be interested in the way that EPA was proposing to proceed under the Clean Water Act.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Emma Chuse for Environmental Appellants. I'd like to address the guidance first. Mountaintop removal mining has already destroyed over 1,200 miles of vital streams in Appalachia. And once that waste is dumped into waters and permanently destroys them, the Court needs to be aware the record shows that harm cannot be undone. While this harm was occurring, federal and state agencies were neglecting Clean Water Act and other existing important legal requirements, and the mining industry got too comfortable. It's now attacking documents like this guidance in which EPA and federal appellants are acknowledging that peer-reviewed science requires them to finally start following existing law. And I'd like to point the court to some of those specific provisions. But to be clear, they're attacking the guidance and the enhanced review memoranda as the messengers. It's the law itself that they take issue with. And appellants should not be punished for engaging transparently in interagency and intra-agency communication about the science and important legal requirements. On the guidance specifically, Your Honor asked what was the purpose. Part of the purpose was to address an important existing regulation that already requires states who have narrative standards to translate those standards into numeric permit limits using current science. The guidance outlines the science on connectivity, providing the science to its own staff so that they are aware that dramatic harm occurs to aquatic life when that range described in the guidance is hit. The states already have an existing duty under 122.44D1, that's in 40 CFR, an existing rule that the district court refused to address. Appellees have been running from because it is the rule that shows exactly why the guidance is consistent with law and did not change anything on conductivity. What changed was the science itself.
It must have changed something on conductivity. That was your whole, that's what you want.
Your Honor, we want
You were unhappy that EPA was allowing permits to be issued that had conductivity levels that were too high and thereby polluting the water.
Your Honor, we want EPA to object, as existing law authorizes them to do, if the state does not translate current science on conductivity and the narrative standards.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Into permit limits.
So all you wanted was a new advocate with the EPA. Existing law was fine, just not being enforced the way you wanted. You want a new advocate? Is that your argument?
Your Honor, we want so much more than what federal appellants did in this case, but the question before the court...
Yeah, we're involved with the legal issue here. And
yes.
The legal issue is whether the regime changed in some way or not. And if it did, there are procedures by which it need to be followed. But it seems to me you're arguing that the regime didn't change. And I'm wondering what role you thought EPA is playing here.
The role EPA is playing is the role delegated by Congress to review state permits. And if they fail to translate narrative standards, which in West Virginia and Kentucky prohibit harm to aquatic life, they fail to translate into permit limits, EPA needs to stand up and object.
But I thought the way EPA was supposed to do that under the statute was to challenge the state water quality standards as inadequate through the 303 process.
No, Your Honor. EPA also has that authority.
Right.
And
that's what you want.
It's,
right.
Your Honor, we also want EPA actually to set a federal water quality standard,
right,
which it has not done here. But the bottom line is that EPA approved the state narrative standards because they should be adequate to protect waters if the states were properly applying them and EPA were properly overseeing that. The regulation, again, that the district court ignored, 40 CFR 122.44D1, already requires states to look at that science and make sure that if, you know, where harm is shown, like conductivity, that they set a numeric limit, even though their state standard doesn't contain that. They have additional authority to set a federal standard. They have authority to disapprove a state standard if it proposed a conductivity limit that was too high.
Hey, correct me if I'm wrong, because isn't EPA's role in reviewing the permit to determine whether it complies with state water quality standards?
Yes, Your Honor, and state standards already prohibit harm to aquatic life, like the kind of harm that occurs when there's conductivity.
Right.
EPA has authority
right,
to interpret.
If the permit, I think what the challengers are saying is that the guidance changes the way EPA is going to handle permit applications, because they're no longer going to look just at whether it meets state water quality standards, but they're going to look at whether the conductivity levels are too high.
Your Honor, they've always had to look.
By the way, I should add that may be entirely lawful, but they're just saying it's reviewable.
Your Honor, I'm addressing the merits here,
okay,
and explaining why EPA is authorized to engage in this.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to reserve a moment for rebuttal, but on this question, EPA is authorized by this regulation to say, are they fully complying with their own narrative standards? EPA may interpret those standards. It may disagree. It may exercise independent judgment and object under 402D2. If the state has not looked at the current science, which it has an obligation to do, and made sure that its narrative standards, which prohibit harm, actually translate into an appropriate limit for various pollutants and indicators like conductivity. I would like to...
So your point, just so I'm clear on that, your point is even if it's reviewable, it's lawful what they did because it's consistent. They're just implementing the regulation.
That's correct. Again, yeah. A regulation the district court ignored, and they have authority to take other action, but this is a narrow step that they at least could do. I would like to briefly address the enhanced coordinated review and reasonable potential analysis, but I recognize I've gone over my time into rebuttal.
Yeah, you have gone over your time. We'll give you 2 minutes back on rebuttal.
Thank you,
but
Your Honor.
But it's for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Okay,
thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Kirsten Nathanson for National Mining Association. To describe our allocation of time, I'm doing 7 minutes to address the enhanced coordination process. Co-counsel from the state of West Virginia and the Commonwealth of Kentucky will be addressing issues related to the final guidance. With regard to the EC process, the government is wrong that this case hinges merely on the ability of agencies to consult with each other and organize their procedures, because such action, you're exactly right, Judge Griffith, must be grounded in the statute. And the precedent.
Why can't two agencies talk to each other all the time about matters of common concern? I don't understand that.
Well, there has to be a basis in authority, and when those actions then turn out.
For agencies to talk to one another?
Well, I will be back. In terms of the in organizing the procedures and that face outward that have then a procedural and substantive effect on the regulated community, agencies only have the power that Congress grants them.
What was the substantive effect on the regulated community from the enhanced coordination process, just from the process?
The process itself imposed both new substantive standards. This is where the conductivity, this is where the rubber met the road with the conductivity standard.
I get you on the conductivity, but just from talking to one another? And coordinating, I'm not sure I see a substantive effect from that.
This goes to, if I can direct the court to the graphic on page 17 of our brief, all right, which outlines the existing regulatory process. We have a pre-existing regulatory scheme in place.
Right.
Agencies can consult and organize with each other, but they have to recognize the scheme that's already in place and has been in place for decades. This is outward-facing. It sets expectations for the regulated community, and we have a Part 325 process that dictates how the Corps is to process, issue, or deny permits.
Mm-hmm.
And here, at the time of the EC process, when the Fourth Circuit litigation ended, 325.2D3 specified what was supposed to happen at that point. That regulation says the 60-day clock is supposed to start again unless one of the six listed exceptions apply. But that's not what happened here. And in this role, what's EPA's pre-existing role in this process? EPA offers public comment.
Is it one of the exceptions for getting more information? Why doesn't that apply?
Yeah, the six exceptions are whether it's precluded as a matter of law or procedures required by law. The case is being referred to a higher authority. But, yes, information needed by the district engineer.
Why doesn't that apply?
Because we don't have anything in this record that reflects the Corps reaching out to EPA and say we need more information on these permits. What I have in the record.
That's the idea for the whole arrangement, right? They need more information. They need.
I guess who is the they who needs more information? That is our point. Because
well,
we have a letter.
The Corps entered into agreement with EPA suggesting that they thought that this was a good arrangement.
And we had a letter from EPA directing the Corps saying, here is how we, EPA, are going to apply the 404B1 guidelines, mm-hmm. even though 404B in the Act only delegates that authority to the Corps itself. And EPA says, here's how we're going to apply our interpretation of the guidelines. Here's how we are going to select this body of permits that we are going to remove from the Part 325 process, and the Corps doesn't explain to anyone why this process no longer applies. It doesn't explain why the 404Q memorandum is suddenly inapplicable.
But your substantive complaint in the end would be either that the permit issuance has been delayed in violation of law or that it's been improperly denied as a matter of law, and you have the ability to bring both those challenges. I don't know why EPA getting involved in talking to the Corps is itself problematic with absent being coupled with a claim about delay or improper denial of a permit.
Well, this was a challenge to the agencies issued the memoranda and mm-hmm. the letters that set forth this brand new process that was a complete departure from the process that has a nexus to the statute. And while counsel for the government referenced declarations, we'd like you to take a look at the declarations because they illustrate how this process is more than just a permit-by-permit challenge and how it programmatically changed for dozens of permits what was supposed to happen here. Just because EPA under 404 has the ability to comment or to veto a permit on a site-specific basis, that doesn't translate to plenary authority to take dozens of permits off the track that literally write 404Q out of the statute.
These are just a number of the sites. And so they can do this on a site-specific basis, and it seems like it's just good government to say, here's a bunch of sites slash permits as to which there could potentially be issues. Let's just have a dialogue about how we're going to resolve these. It's something, you're absolutely right. It can be. The statute calls for the EPA to have a role in it at the back end. And what they're saying is, well, we have a role at the back end. The Corps has a role at the front end. Let's get together and talk about these particular group of permits. Let's get together and talk about these.
Well, that's right in terms of but Judge Walton was exactly right about how the specific language of the plain language of 404 and how it allocated authority between these agencies.
But 404Q, which the government didn't cite, at least in response to my question, doesn't 404Q say that in this very circumstance, for an efficiency rationale, we want them to work together? Isn't that the grant of authority Congress gave the EPA to do just what they did here?
And they issued, they were mandated to enter into an agreement. It mandated statutorily mandated agreement on that, and they did that in 1992. And that when they issued this process, they were silent on the 1992 agreement. That is the basis of our complaint, that they entered into this brand new process where they had complete blinders on to the processes that have been in place for decades. We have no explanation as to why the 404Q process, which is quite detailed, which provides for elevation of specific permits.
So is your argument now you're not contesting that 404Q gives them the authority to have this sort of cooperative agreement? You just say that they didn't give an adequate explanation for doing so here?
They created something out of whole cloth and ignored the prior scheme, and they acted inconsistent with the existing with the Part 325 process and the 404Q memoranda. There simply isn't basis in the statute for them to create out of whole cloth something new that is different from what had been done for decades. To direct you to the declarations that lay this out, the Cook Declaration at JA 440, Higgins at 434, Horn at 428, these folks describe how their permit applications were filed, how the public comment period had been complete, how EPA did not comment on their permits during the public comment period, how they had received their 401 state water quality certifications, how the Corps was telling them in meetings that their permits were ripe for review, and yet when the Fourth Circuit litigation cleared, they were instead moved to this new process where they sat for months and months and months.
In violation of what? Was there a statute that said the decision had to be made by a certain point?
Well, we have 404Q, which says that the Corps and the EPA and all the other federal agencies have to do all they can to the maximum extent practicable to reach a permit decision within 90 days. Mm-hmm. And then we have 325.2D3 in the Corps regulations, which say within 60 days of the end of a comment period, you have to issue a permit unless one of these six exceptions apply. And they didn't even invoke 325.2D3 in the contemporaneous records when they issued this process.
So why isn't the challenge here a delay challenge rather than a challenge to the process? In other words, who cares what process they used? The problem is they delayed the issuance of permits beyond deadlines that are set forth in statute or rule.
Because the harm to at least our members was more than the delay. Because as part of this process, EPA, when they were doing the screening function, they were substantively changing the standards that were governing 404
permits.
Well,
that gets to the substantive challenge here. But the other argument is not just the delay, but the permits should have been issued that weren't issued.
Yes. That is our argument as well, Your Honor.
Okay.
But we believe, that the agency, there's no doubt there was a change in policy. There's no doubt that the agency wanted to slow down and halt the issuance of these permits. We brought this suit so that those policy changes would be implemented in accordance with the law, and we ask the court to affirm. And I'll cede the floor to Mr. Bailey. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, I'm Ben Bailey. It's my privilege to represent my home state of West Virginia.
Kentucky and I have split up this portion of our argument, although it is sometimes hard to do. I'm going to leave the RPA issues, which uniquely affect Kentucky, to my colleagues from Kentucky, and I'll talk about the final guidance, why we think it's final, why we think it's binding, and why we think the conductivity standard is a de facto water quality standard. Those, Judge Walton addressed those issues sequentially, but they're sort of conflated. I stand here representing a state. States are the primary regulators of the coal industry. They're primarily responsible for the quality of their waters. We adopt water quality standards.
Can't the states ignore the guidance?
Yes. They can, but at their peril.
And at their peril in a subsequent individual permitting decision.
No, Your Honor. If they ignore it, as mentioned in Appalachian Power, it has changed our obligations. The finality, the harm, is in changing the agency's obligations, is in forcing down the state agency's throats a standard which the state, in West Virginia's case, has said conductivity should not apply.
So why doesn't the state just say we're going to ignore this guidance, and what happens to the state if it does that? Some of its permits will be objected to by EPA, presumably.
Permits can be objected to. The state's staffing has to change. The state's program can be endangered. You have seen the affidavits from Linda Bornazian and Ms. McKnight saying we fully expect these, quote, objections or, quote, comments to be adhered to, or we will take further action, which they can do not only in reviewing or taking away permits and deciding them on their own in standards that don't apply in our state, or in further review of our existing programs. The state's point is that if EPA wants a standard for conductivity, if it wants a standard for anything, it has a way to do that. It failed to do that in this case. It has three roles in setting standards, the EPA does, and they're limited and they're set by Congress. The 303 standards we've talked about. States promulgate the regs, EPA approves them or not. Or they can tell you you need to change them and the state changes them, and if the state fails to and EPA thinks it's serious enough, they promulgate their own. EPA also has a second way to do what I think it would, what it professes to be trying to do here, which is in establishing a non-binding standard for states to follow under 304 of the Clean Water Act. At page 70 of the government's brief, I think sort of throwing themselves on the grenade, they address that problem. Mm-hmm. If EPA wanted the states to advance the science and consider new standards, they have the 304 avenue to promulgate new standards or new practices. They didn't do that.
Can I ask you this question
Sure.
I'm sorry to stop you before the third one, but
remind me where I was.
I'm sorry. If your point is that the conductivity standards have binding effect, how does that square with, I guess it's a different EPA region, but EPA Region 5's actions vis-a-vis Ohio? Because EPA Region 5 was fine with approving for Ohio, even though the threshold level was far in excess of the 300 to 500 bandwidth.
Well, the guidance document itself, the initial guidance purported to affect certain ecoregions. The final guidance limited it, and our brief argues at one point that that's arbitrary and capricious, also limited it within ecoregions to the political boundaries of the states of West Virginia and Kentucky. I think that EPA took this tack, precisely it's a litigation position in many ways, but precisely to preserve the opportunity to make that argument. But within West Virginia and Kentucky, within our regimes, it applies from our perspective, with the force of the law, and change the way that we have done things forever, particularly important in West Virginia, which has specifically eschewed paying any attention to conductivity. I think that's how we get there.
So your argument, you're acquiescing in the notion that your argument is geographically confined?
It has been in practice, yes.
Which is the whole argument is one in practice, because I take it no one takes issue with the proposition that on its face the guidance doesn't purport to be binding. In fact, it purports not to be.
Well, actually, we do take issue with that. I mean, if you take the literal reading, it says, Queen Gertrude in Hamlet, methinks they doth protest too much seven times, so this is not binding in the first two pages. I do take issue with that. It was meant to be binding. It was announced in advance. It was a part of this enhanced coordination process and review that was designed to apply it to the Appalachian states. Whether it would be applied out west or elsewhere, it hasn't been yet. That's true. But EPA has ways to do this right. What they were trying to do was jumpstart the science, was evade the statutory opportunities they have and the regulatory ones to advance the science and do it properly. And instead of doing that,
they should mention your third one.
Pardon? My third one was that they have the opportunity to comment or object under CFR 123.44. And as you can see in the Clark Declaration and the other items from folks in the industry, the place where the state's obligations were dramatically altered under the language of Appalachian Power was when the EPA started sending these letters. They could call them objections. They could call them comments. They all echo the language of the final guidance document, and they feel really final. I cited three or four of them.
Now, what about Ms. Chu's point that they're just enforcing the regulation or fleshing out the regulation when they do that, or that the guidance fleshes out the regulation? Can you respond to that point?
I can, Your Honor. I'd refer you to the letter in the record at 625, which is an objection letter to Mr. Clark, which talks about the effluent limitations, and they're not fleshing anything out. They say the permit, and I quote, must be revised to add effluent limitations at valley fill outfalls such as conductivity, TDS, and sulfates. That's not any discussion or comment that's fleshing out an interpretation of the narrative water quality standard. That's an order. The permit must be amended.
Her point, that I think, was that's an order that's fine on the merits, I think, if I'm...
And we think because it is a wholly new standard for conductivity, because it is, in effect, a water quality standard, it is not that at all. Mm-hmm. If they want to add conductivity, if they want to add any of the constituents of conductivity to the water quality standards that my client agency is supposed to enforce, they have a way to do that. They can't, and Congress was pretty clear about the list of substances and the list of pollutants and how we're supposed to discuss and arrive at the science. What EPA did here on its own was just decide what science is right instead of avoiding the statutory and regulatory methods for fully fleshing that out, which is all we ask for.
Back on the reviewability point, Mr. Littleton would say that all your substantive objections to what they're saying about conductivity can be made in a future challenge in litigation when the state has decided to issue a permit, EPA objects, the state can then initiate litigation, and at that point we can determine whether EPA's insistence on a certain conductivity level is consistent with law. Why not do it that way and have a focused challenge like that?
One could do it that way, of course, Your Honor, but just as in Appalachian Power, my state agency needs to do it now. It was not an accident that the EC process and the MIRA screening process and the interim guidance on April Fool's Day of 2010 all came out together.
Or what, though? You need to do it now or what? If you just say, we're not going to do that, then there's going to be a focused challenge soon enough, right?
There may be or there may not be.
Why would there
right?
not be?
If EPA will back off, then maybe there would or wouldn't be.
But there'd be litigation, won't there? Isn't there
enough?
In other words, if the state says, forget about this, guys, we're not following that, then EPA, then they're going to, you're going to have a permit that you want to issue or approve, if I'm using the terminology correctly. EPA is going to object. You're not going to work it out, and litigation will ensue a year from now, 2 years from now. Now, I can ask EPA, why is that more efficient than this, or why does that make sense under Avalanche? But I'm asking you, why is that a problem to do it that way?
Well, it's a problem first because it is inefficient, and states have limited resources. We don't want to be here particularly right now. Mm-hmm. Second, we've had to expend enormous amounts of resources, and if this discussion is going to continue on responding to objections and comments about conductivity, which we've said aren't in our standards, and if we're going to keep operating in this netherworld where our standards are what they are, they've never objected to them. Our narrative water quality standard is what it is. It's been put
in
place.
So what is going on now on the ground? Because the district court's opinion is in effect. What is happening?
I wish I knew fully. There are a lot of people watching what you're doing and waiting to see what happens in this court. Mm-hmm. It's not in the record, Your Honor, but I'm told that the same concerns and the same standards, the 500 microsiemen standard, and the same discussions that are set out pretty fully in the record, which just encompasses a few months right after the final guidance became final. Mm-hmm. But that same process and those same issues are manifesting themselves in the same way, and in many instances causing exactly what the administrator predicted, to avoid the application of this conductivity guideline. Operators are eliminating valley fill.
Is there a case that's in the pipeline for litigation, an individualized case?
I don't know. Okay. I don't know one. And I'm sorry that I ate up so much of Kentucky's time. I hope you will be good to them.
We will. I ate it up.
We are ready for counsel for Kentucky if they want to argue. If they don't, going once, going twice.
I think you hit.
Okay. We'll give her time when she comes back. But there's nothing to rebut yet.
Yeah.
We'll adjourn until counsel for Kentucky comes back. Thank you.
Stand, please. Mr. Oliver, we'll take a short recess. Everyone, please take a seat. We're going to get started shortly. Thank you. Stand, please. Be seated, please.
Stevens.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Mary Stevens. I'm here on behalf of the Commonwealth of Kentucky, which has been the permitting authority within its state borders for 31 years. In my 6.5 minutes, I'll address the new requirement in EPA's final guidance that states conduct a reasonable potential analysis prior to issuing an NPDES permit. Such action is outside the authority granted EPA in the Clean Water Act, and so is arbitrary, capricious, and unlawful. As Mr. Bailey acknowledged, the Clean Water Act gives to the states the primary responsibility and right to protect water quality within their borders. The final guidance usurps the right of the state to promulgate and implement their water quality standards.
I thought your primary challenge on this, on the merits, was that it was inconsistent with an existing EPA regulation.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But that EPA regulation, as I read it, doesn't speak specifically to the timing of the RPA, and thus EPA's interpretation now stands unless it's plainly inconsistent with the existing reg under the standards, and since it doesn't speak to it, I'm having trouble seeing how it's plainly inconsistent with the existing regs.
Well, Your Honor, the 40 CFR 122.44 sub D, mm-hmm. which is the regulation you're referencing, mm-hmm. Does not specifically include any timing requirement for the reasonable potential analysis. However, it clearly contemplates that such analysis will be conducted after permit issuance and after the discharge commences.
Is that based on the tense of a few words?
The tense is an indicator. However, Judge 122.44 sub D sub 1 sub 2, I believe, if that's the excruciatingly correct, says that the permitting authority shall consider specific factors in conducting the reasonable potential analysis, and those factors are the variability of the pollutant in the discharge and the dilution of the effluent in the receiving stream. Clearly, those measurements can't be taken until a discharge has begun, until there is a discharge to do those assessments on. The relying on the regulation and EPA's 1991 technical support document for water quality-based toxins control, Kentucky had for decades issued permits for new and expanded discharges from surface mining operations that required that the permittee submit 2 years of site-specific monitoring data, and also included a permit reopener clause so that if the 2 years of site-specific data demonstrate reasonable potential of the effluent to exceed state water quality standards, then new effluent limits or other permit conditions could be imposed. This was Kentucky's practice for at least 20 years prior to issuance of the guidance. Prior to issuance of the final guidance, EPA had never objected to a NPDES permit issued by Kentucky for a new or expanded surface mining discharge because it didn't have a pre-permit reasonable potential analysis. In fact, EPA had never objected to any Kentucky NPDES permit for surface mining. Now, the final guidance tells states they shall assume reasonable potential of discharge from surface mining operations will violate the final guidance's conductivity standard, or states shall conduct a reasonable potential analysis before issuing the permit. And since issuance of the final guidance, EPA has objected to every individual permit, has objected to and in fact blocked every individual permit proposed by Kentucky for a new or expanded discharge from a surface mine in the eastern Kentucky coal fields that did not impose the final guidance conductivity standard or include a pre-permit reasonable potential analysis.
But has that been predicated on an assessment by EPA that in those particular instances there is the potential for contributing to violations of the effluent limitations? In other words, are they focused on the circumstances of the particular instances?
They are commenting, or objecting to, a particular permit. However, the impact of the pre-permit reasonable potential analysis is to stop, to change Kentucky's permitting practices, to cause Kentucky to undergo an analysis on non-site-specific data, whereas Kentucky always believed that site-specific data was preferable to general data drawn from some other watershed, another state. It was Kentucky's preference and practice for 20 years to do that analysis on site-specific data. And EPA's objections are inconsistent for failure to do a pre-permit reasonable potential analysis, are inconsistent with the plain wording of the regulation, and exceed EPA's authority under the Clean Water Act, and has totally stymied Kentucky's NPDES permitting program.
Thank you. We have your argument. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Littleton, we'll give you 3 minutes for rebuttal, and Ms. Chews will give you 2. Does that sound good? Okay. For rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly on the enhanced coordination process and screening procedure, I'd point out that Ms. Nathanson went back to her regulatory and 404Q memorandum claims, which plaintiffs did not move for summary judgment on that ground. So those claims have been forfeited. In any event, the regulations that dealing with timing, 325.2D, that's non-mandatory, as we point out in our brief, and a relevant exception applies. Turning to the guidance memo, West Virginia admitted that the states can ignore the guidance. Now, are there going to be practical consequences to that? Likely so, because in individual cases, EPA may comment or object to permits that don't contain the 300 to 500 conductivity limit. But the question is,
when you say likely so, that poses the whole Appalachian Power question, for me at least, which is, Abbott Labs allowed pre-enforcement review. That was a sea change in administrative law. And then agencies got wise about avoiding pre-enforcement review by putting in what Appalachian Power calls boilerplate, cited a law review article talking about agency charades. And so Appalachian Power essentially stepped in and said, we're not going to be fooled, and we're not going to allow agencies to get around Abbott Labs. And one of the questions that we're supposed to look at are the practical consequences. And I think you've said there are affected parties, there are practical consequences to ignoring this. And doesn't that then mean we should review its legality now rather than 3 years from now, which will help all involved, actually, in terms of certainty and efficiency?
Well, it comes down to the record, I think, Your Honor, because as the plaintiffs have conceded, the guidance on its face is non-binding. And so the question is, how was it actually implemented? And we presented several examples of permits that were issued without these
just limitations. On its face, not binding. Haven't we said that that alone doesn't solve the question?
That's right. It's not just positive. But the question then is, can the plaintiffs come forward with evidence that it's been practically implemented in a legally binding fashion? And they haven't in this case. There's no example they pointed to of an NPDES permit issued with limitations in the supposed conductivity limit range. However, we pointed to several examples where permits were issued without that limitation. And I would point out further that EPA was, before the guidance was instituted, was making the same recommendation. The only thing that's changed is, in certain cases, EPA has stepped up its scrutiny of particular applications and has taken the further step to object, which it has discretionary authority to do under the statute.
One of the things Appalachian Power says is to look at if the guidance leads private parties or state permitting authorities to believe that it will declare permits invalid unless they comply with the terms of the document. And don't you think it's reasonable for private parties and state permitting agencies now to believe that permits will be declared invalid unless they comply with the terms of the guidance?
Not given the record in this case, Your Honor, of several permits that were issued without these limitations.
Obviously, you really believe that in the real world? I mean, one of the things Appalachian Power is, I think, telling future courts is don't be fooled by what's stated in the document if it's just not reflective of what's going on in the real world. And you really think in the real world this guidance, it's just really doesn't mean much?
I mean, I guess it's a question of
meaning. That's not how it was advertised. I don't think that's how it's – that's certainly not how people who are regulated think. And all they're asking for is review. The second question is legality.
Again, I would point the court to, in addition to Appalachian Power, the court's case law and Center for Auto Safety, mm-hmm. home builders, a number of subsequent cases after Appalachian Power where the court has explained that there needs to be a certain change in legal obligations. Simply an agency expressing its view of the law is not enough to make agency action binding and reviewable.
Increased burden isn't enough either, is it, right?
No, it's not. And with respect to the reasonable potential analysis, Kentucky's argument, I would just point out she referred the court to the technical support document from 1991 at JA 927. As we explained in our brief, that document explains that the question is, in light of available, when a state issues an NPDES permit, it is necessarily making a determination that all effluent limitations necessary are included in the permit. And if there is available information that the state is not fully considering, that's a reasonable basis for EPA to object. And I would also point the court to, beginning at page JA 1124, a number of examples where, before the guidance memo had issued, EPA was pointing out a deficiency in Kentucky's Section 402 permits.
Can you address the regulation that Ms. Chews mentioned on the merits of the conductivity issue?
Section 122.44D1, mm-hmm. That's a regulation that refers to the RPA aspect. It's not a – it doesn't have to do with the particular issue raised in the context of conductivity.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You disagree with what the government just said, don't you?
Yes, I'm relying on the guidance's reliance on that regulation mm-hmm. in explaining its guidance on conductivity, and we've cited those pages in our brief. Mm-hmm. But briefly to respond on this regulation specifically requires D16 that the state flesh out the narrative standards using new science. And I'd like to make clear for the court that each West Virginia and Kentucky are trying to avoid application of their existing narrative standards, which we've cited at page 12 to 17 of our brief and are in JA 1114 to 15. As an example, they prohibit already under West Virginia state law conditions that are not allowable are conditions, materials that are harmful, hazardous, or toxic to man, animal, or aquatic life. That's 3.2E, 3.2I. No significant adverse impact to the chemical, physical, hydrologic, or biological components of aquatic systems shall be allowed. Conductivity, harm from conductivity is precisely the kind of harm their standards already prohibit. The EPA has authority to oversee and ensure that they're implementing that science under that regulation.
And that's a merits argument, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Trying to distinguish.
It also illustrates that the binding requirements that already apply are the binding regulations themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Kentucky and West Virginia are honestly stating that EPA is trying to jumpstart the science that they've been running from, and that is true. EPA has been trying to put forward new science to its staff to ensure that they are fulfilling their responsibility to review permits in the context of the new science, as the reasonable potential analysis regulation provides. The reasonable potential analysis does use a future term, potential, as we've cited in our brief. It would gut the purpose of Section 301 of the Act, which prohibits a discharge into U.S. waters without a permit designed to protect them, for EPA not to be able to object based on the lack of a proper reasonable potential analysis, and it's unclear how they can satisfy that without performing the analysis before the permit is issued. Recognizing that the guidance does not go that far, it simply says it should be done before, particularly where here you have a record of dramatic environmental harm the state can use to perform that analysis. on Section 404C, Ms. Nathanson is asking for the court to, in essence, protect the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers as a fragile agency away in a bubble from EPA. The two agencies acted together to recognize that it would assist the exercise of their independent authorities to be able to review these permit applications. And 404C explicitly authorizes EPA to consult before, whenever it determines that's necessary, as an ongoing authority, not just a veto power. It may issue a determination at any time before a permit application, while it's being reviewed, or afterward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted.